Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this conference call for the 2012 Ontology Summit on the 22nd of March 2012. This afternoon, I'm delighted to say we have some excellent speakers. Could I have my slides up, please, Peter?
Oh, yes.
We're looking at big systems, and in particular, we're looking today at two of the items that have come out from the discussion on tracks 1 and 2, the ontology of system components and system modelling language requirements. And my name is Matthew West, and I'm chairing this session. Next slide, please, Peter. Okay, so our agenda this afternoon is that we have two speakers on each of these subjects. On system components, Dr. Nicola Guarino is going to talk about functional roles and their realizations. And Mr. Chris Partridge is going to talk about system components as a litmus test for your ontological architecture. And in fact, of course, they're both speaking about the same thing, but from different perspectives. System components are one of the things in systems engineering that are not generally particularly well dealt with in general ontologies. And both of these represent good work that's being done in that area. And then secondly, we have the topic of engineering and modelling languages. And David Leal has prepared a presentation, which unfortunately he's not able to make, so I will make on his behalf, on some thoughts on requirements for languages and engineering. And that will be followed by Dr. Henson Graves, and a presentation he has for using ontology to meet big systems challenges. Again, both of those are presentations in the same area of engineering data modelling languages. Okay, and that concludes my introduction, and I'd like to hand over to Dr. Nicola Guarino for his presentation on functional roles and their realizations.
Okay, hi everybody, thanks Matthew. So let's start from slide 2, which is the summary of this presentation. I will mainly focus on roles. There are many problems related to the notion of roles. They are still heavily debated in the literature. In particular, I will focus on what does it mean to realize a role. The notion of role I'm assuming is a kind of abstract notion, and the point is what happens when we make this role. For instance, when we have a certain idea of a particular pump in an oil plant, and we want actually to put this pump in place. Indeed, the kind of notion of roles I'm supporting in this talk is pretty much sticking to the original idea of roles as parts in a play. So in the past, in particular, I must say I did some amount of work on roles, assuming that roles are properties. In this talk, I'm actually refining a little bit this idea, exploring the relationship existing between roles as abstract parts of a certain kind of abstract structure, abstract context, want, having the property of playing this role. Anyway, going to slide 3, the main problems behind the notion of roles, in my opinion, are two with many variants. So on one hand, we need to understand the nature of what we call the role-playing relationship. For instance, the relationship existing between that particular physical artifact, which is the pump, and something called the role the pump plays in the circuit. Indeed, the nature of this relationship is to be investigated. For instance, do we say that intuitively a pedestrian is a role? Is this guy actually playing this role? You know, the word play implies some kind of activity, you know? For instance, an ocular witness. Is the ocular witness playing a role, or just this guy is in a role? It happens to be in the role. And similarly, when we consider the property of being driving or being teaching, and the person which exhibits this property, is there a difference between just exhibiting the property of driving or being driving and being the driver of a car? When in English there are distinctions between these two terms, and I must say my own treatment of roles until now is not able to capture this distinction. Also, even more subtly, is there a difference between being a driver and being a passenger of a car? Is there a difference between being a customer and an employee? Apparently, these terms, these prophecies, they have similarly, but we shall see that there is a difference. And, okay, this concerns the relationship between the guy who plays the role and the role itself. And of course, the second problem is, what are roles after all? Are they properties? Are they individuals? What is the kind of ontological machinery, the ontological assumptions we need to make when we refer to these things in the everyday speaking? I will skip the counting problem, the player replacement problem, and so on, because we shall go, we shall see these issues later. So let's go to the slide number 4, which in a sense exposes my own point of view, which is a common sense point of view, a cognitive point of view, strongly motivated by the desire to account for the everyday understanding, everyday speaking of people dealing with roles, including engineers and technicians and so on. So this is, in order to compare it with the position defended by Matthew and Chris and other people, these are just, let's say, two different points of view. Their point of view is, in a sense, more realist, for sure, more to the, let's say, to the hard, to the level, at the level of the hard things. And my position is more on the level of concepts. So I would say that this position is a constructivist position, while their position is a realist position. But of course, I don't think it is relevant to debate the deep philosophical attitude behind these things. My own role is mainly motivated to the desire of accounting for interesting cognitive and linguistic distinctions. For instance, going to the examples reported in this slide, certainly language makes a difference between referring to the driving property in the adverb or with the nominalization of the verb. There are different contexts where you use the verb or use the noun. For instance, the driver can be having a beer. He is not actually driving, but he is still a driver. And so this is one issue concerning to the fact that we use different linguistic structures, linguistic terms for things which are related to each other. Then there are some aspects related to the proper use of comparatives when we use roles. I can say that John has a good friend. It is less natural to say that John has a good classmate. For instance, we can say, this guy is a good driver. You don't say, this guy is a good pedestrian. Maybe you can say, this guy is a good passenger, but it means something else, something very, very precise. The whole point behind these distinctions is that is that the need to clarify the assumptions why a certain construction seems less natural than another one. So this concerns the fact that we can compare, let's say, we can in a sense judge how well a person feels a certain role for certain kinds of roles and not for other kinds of roles. Another issue is replaceability, which is of particular relevance for discussion with Chris and Matthew here and in engineering design in general. Certain roles are such, it is natural to replace their fillers. A teacher is an example. Tire in the example Chris is going to make on the cars or the pump is certainly of this kind. When I say friend, okay, well, it is less natural. I can replace my teacher, but I change a friend. Maybe you can replace a friend, but this implies certain assumptions. So this is the general motivations let's say my own attitude to the problem of roles. Now let's go to slide 5, which conveys the idea of realization, which of course it is very, very obvious. I have a design in my mind. I start sketching what I want to realize, and then I actually start modifying some material, some actual matter in order to realize what I have in mind. So for sure, it is pretty obvious in an engineering context that we have an abstract level and an actual level. And let's go now to the slide 6 to investigate a little bit the nature of this abstract level. slide 6 describes a very, very, very abstract context, relational context. So there is an orientation, and there is an ordering, implicit ordering, and there is a way to label things placed, positioned according to this order. There is the front thing, the middle thing, and the back thing. This is an example of describing in a very abstract terms a relational situation. Relational context. And the labels I'm attaching to these bullets here are roles. Roles actually denote or describe the parts played by things in this particular context. So whatever will be in that position will play the back role. Now, suppose I have this abstract context on my glasses and I look around and we go to slide number 7. So I have this concept in my mind of order, and I use this context in order to judge that in this case the meadow is in the front, and the mountains are in the back, and the lake is in the middle. So in this way, in a sense, these roles, which were abstract in my mind, are being realized by something concrete, something physical. Okay? So that green stuff which I can touch close to me plays the role of the front thing. The mountains over there are the back thing, and so on and so on. So basically, the realization relation results from a kind of projection relationship. And this projection, in this case, between the reality and the concepts, in this case, this projection is undeliberate. I don't want to realize that particular order. It is just there. Okay, it happens to be the case that the lake is between the meadow and the mountain. Now let's go to slide number 8. This is another example of a context, of an abstract context. Of course, I'm using some support, some graphical support to describe what I have in mind. But this, besides the fact that the graphical support of the line itself is physical, the thing I have in mind is just in my mind, is an abstract context, and describes a particular relationship between things, okay, like walls and windows and trees and so on and so forth. And this particular structure is something I call the house I want to build. And still at this level, I can stick to the drama metaphor for thinking of the various windows. For instance, there are three windows, five windows, two doors. Okay, each of these particular windows has a name. Okay, and the name is a kind of character this entity is going to play in for my drama. So roles are like characters in an abstract structure. Now suppose I want to project this context. This is a context. I want really to realize it, and we go to slide 9. Okay, now I want to realize the house, okay, and I project this stuff on the external reality. And not only I want to realize this, but I want to realize a next situation. This is slide 10. So the house is there in order to allow me to enjoy living there with my friends and my guests and so on. Okay, so specifying the realization means specifying the goals of these realizations as well. So why I'm going to build the house. Now, all this machinery is, which is pretty obvious, of course, pretty naive as a picture, is there to allow me to consider the different roles which I can realize. The house is a kind of container. There are things there. There is furniture. Maybe there is rubbish there. There are stuff. And the content of the house, in general, I have no expectations about that. I can say I replace the content of my house. It's a bit strange. Let's consider another role, which is owner or guest. I have expectations. I have expectations concerning the behavior of these things, and I can change a guest, but I can't replace a guest. On the contrary, for other roles like door, roof, furniture, in this case, the replacement is allowed. Now let's go to slide number 11. Suppose we are starting building the house, and the house is under construction, and we say, oh look, we are in the living room, and the window is there on the back, on the back of the lady. So for these people, these things, the living room and the window, in a sense, are virtually there. And my point is that these virtual realizations emerge as soon as I start placing my intentionally placing my house in a certain place, and start when I lay the first bricks and so on. It is as if my window is there. Indeed, I say the window is missing, but I refer to something there, which is in a virtual state. So this is my main point. Let's go to the slide number 12. The idea is that once the location where I want to build the house is fixed, and once the first stone is poured, the house starts to exist virtually, as well as its own walls, and so on and so forth. And these walls are waiting to be actually realized as a consequence of an arbitrary selection of the appropriate components. It is arbitrary to decide what kind of bricks I will put there. Because whenever there is a functional role, the functional role implies this freedom of substitution for the thing which plays that role. Let's go to slide number 13. So this marks the difference between ordinary roles and the functional roles. The functional roles are replaceable. So this is the case of our P101, which is the name of a role in the design. Since it is a functional role, it can be replaced. And since it is a functional role, as soon as the plant is being built in that particular case, in that particular location, a virtual object is created. Of course, I'm aware there is a big debate about the ontological status of these virtual components, because we can ask ourselves, what are these things? And to motivate the relevance of introducing these entities in our ontologies, let me make the organization example, moving from the engineering domain to the organizational domain. So, consider the classical example of the president of a country like Italy. We distinguish between the presidents and the presidency, and we distinguish between the legal person and the physical person. So the idea is the same. In order to account for certain ways we talk of the presidency of the republic, we have to distinguish these two things, and we have to allow the case that the presidency of the republic remains the same also if the actual people which embody this role are changing. And by the way, people can send letters to the presidency even while the presidency is vacant. So maybe, of course, in order for the presidency to have causal powers, some physical person needs to be there. But in order for the presidency to establish social relationships with the other people, okay, citizens, it is not even necessary for the president being there. The presidency is still there even while the actual person is not there. Finally, slide number 15 gives a picture of the situation, the possible implementation of these ideas. The boxes are properties, and the ovals are individuals. So there is the property of being the president of Italy, which is instantiated by an individual, which is Napolitano right now. Napolitano has a certain relationship with another individual, which is a virtual individual, which is the presidency of the republic. And the relationship they establish with the president role are different, because Napolitano complies with this role, while the presidency, by definition, has to satisfy this role. As a role, you can think of the role as the set of specifications concerning the behavior and the requirements and so on. And by the way, the presidency of Italy is, as an individual, instantiate another property, which is the property of being the president of Italy and the property of being a legal person. But this property is rigid. You cannot, its instances are always there, are necessarily such, while the property of being the president of Italy is not rigid. Note that I'm not saying anymore, with respect to previous work, I'm not saying that president of Italy, the box, is the role. Is the role property, is not the role. The role is an individual. Slide 16 gives a more complicated picture. I will omit there. You can look at it yourself. Basically, this remarks the fact that a role is not alone. A role is just an abstract part of an abstract context. So there is not just the president, there is the president in the context of the parliament, and the relationship between the two are described by the constitution. I'm going to skip slide 17, which just stresses the difference between satisfying a role and complying with a role. And slide 18 just poses again the questions we have seen in general for roles, to the particular case of artifacts. And I believe that these four natural language statements reflect the way people talk of these things. And in order to what we need is to have a model which allows you to isolate the reference of the term right headlamp in all these statements. And I claim that this is not possible to do without allowing for these virtual things. And slide 19 now, of course, the discussion requires to be a little bit more detailed. Once we admit these virtual things, we have to ask ourselves what are the properties, the qualities of these virtual things, and we have to distinguish between nominal properties and actual properties. And when a particular thing is just in the virtual state, of course, the actual properties, the actual qualities are not there. And we can basically, let's say, consider the mass, for instance, of the pump. There is a nominal mass, which is the expected one, and an actual mass, which might be different. These are two different qualities which share the same quality space, adopting the Dolce ontology terminology. Finally, this the slide number 20 is just a suggestion which conveys this idea of the fact that virtual realizations are cognitively real in a sense. For us, the legs and the feet of this guy are there, even if in a virtual state. They are not realized yet, but we can ascribe them a location and some properties. I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicola. I'm immensely pleased that you're paying so much attention to this area. What I suggest is, I notice there are already some questions on the forum, so I'm going to suggest that we defer questions, since amongst other things we're running a bit late already, and if we can deal with questions on the SOAP Hub, I think that also means that we have a record of the answers as well. So if I can suggest that we do that for questions. And then if we can move on, please, to Chris Partridge. Nicola has already mentioned that Chris has a different view of system components. And that's what we're going to hear about now.
Okay. This is an old topic, and in fact, it's a topic that Nicola and I talked about, I think, over 10 years ago. In the late 90s, when I was working with him, we talked about it quite a bit. I suspect our positions have both been refined, but probably not basically changed. The reason that this interests me is, if you can go to slide two, is that the system components are quite an interesting litmus test about what's going on. They exhibit a number of problems, and you can use them to try and identify how you're approaching ontology. And if we move to slide three, one of the reasons why this is important is that if you're trying to build a large-scale system of any kind, you need some kind of organization. And if you're trying to build a large-scale system with a large-scale ontology, it's quite important to have an ontology architecture. And I know there have been some papers on this and some people talking about it, but it seems to me it's something that's not focused on enough. And it seems to me that one of the tests you can apply to your building of a large-scale system, and I think Henson was actually going to say something similar later on, is that how well you organize it, what kind of architecture you have. And I actually think Nicola's paper exhibits some of these properties. He was looking at the architecture and the way it works. I would like to just look at the system component in a little bit of detail and just try and draw out the kind of issues it raises, the kind of ontological principles that are at stake, and also suggest some answers as a way of exhibiting about a way in which you could start showing the architecture that's in play when you're trying to go down this particular route. If we can go to slide four. One of the issues, I think, when talking about ontological architecture is the architectural principles can, in practice, actually become quite abstract and lose their connection with reality. Or something a bit more subtle is that they can have this connection, but we don't understand how this connection comes into play. And the nice thing about these kind of examples like system components or a particular system component, Nicola's headlamp, I'm going to talk about a wheel. I think there's a Matthew often talks about a pump. I've got a paper on a pump. All of these are things that are easy to relate to. And in fact, the problems are if you spend a little bit of time, easy to relate to. So it's a good way of establishing the connection back with reality. If we go to slide five, I'm going to suggest, if you like, a rough schematic for the approach. I'm going to say that you set up the example. You then need to look at the issues and principles at stake, and then you need to identify and justify your architectural choices. And you can also probably should show how they impact the example, so that at least at the low level of the example, you can see the impact they're going to have. And I think if you're involved in a large-scale system and you run your litmus test and you can't deliver on stages two and three, I think you've got some kind of problem. And I think also one of the other things that is important to be clear about is the role of intuition and natural language. And as Nicola said when he was doing his presentation, for him the conceptual structure and the natural language are quite important. And I think they are useful. They're useful in a number of different ways. As I say in the slide, they're useful for the man in the streets trying to get a starting point into what's going on. But if you are involved in a large-scale engineering system, you need to assess whether they're all that's required. And I'd suggest that if you need to ask yourself, if engineers were building a new offshore oil rig, would they take their intuitions and the way in which people describe it in natural language as a final arbiter? And I suggest they might well not. In fact, they don't. And I think there's something else going on here. We need an industrial strength architecture for an industrial strength project. So if we go to slide six, this is stage one in my simple schematic. We have a car. It has a front rear tire. When the car is built, I'm not sure whether cars are built or whatever the correct verb is, a tire is installed on the front right-hand side of the car. At some point in time, the tire is taken off and a new tire installed. One of the things that's always useful to do in this case, and I think Nicola mentioned before, is a counting problem, is you count how many things there are. There's a car, there's a front right tire, there's the original tire and the replacement tire. And you can immediately start seeing some of the problems that we've got here, is that there seem to be more. If you look at a car, you don't see four objects. You only seem to see, let me get it right, you probably see two objects, which is the car and the car's front right tire, that might be the original tire or the replacement tire, depending on the time you see it. And so we need to try and explain what the connection between these things are. And I think it happens, maybe we get the structure right automatically in our head, at least well enough to be able to go about everyday tasks. But if we're trying to build this large-scale system, how are we going to deal with this? A standard sort of problem of configuration management. What I'd like to do now on slide seven is try and pick out some of the ontological issues and principles in play here. The first is one that goes back, I think, to Aristotle, in maybe even earlier. It's, can two things be in the same place at the same time? There's a feeling that it may be difficult if they can be. And it obviously makes pointing quite difficult. So if I point towards the car's front right wheel, am I pointing at the original tire, the replacement tire, or the car's front right tire? Okay, I can tell the difference between the original tire and the replacement tire, but how do I tell the difference between the car's front right tire and, let's say, it's the original tire there now? How do I tell which one I'm pointing to? And we see, if there are two different things, they do seem to be in the same place at the same time. And I think behind this is a principle of identity and difference at a time, and there's an associated principle, which is the nature of change over time. And in a sense that once we realize these principles are in play, we want to try and devise an answer at this more general level, which we can roll out across the whole architecture. And it's got to work across the whole architecture, but at least in this one place. The next problem is, can the same thing be different at different times? And that makes re-identification difficult. Now, clearly from our description, the car has different tires as parts at different times. Does this make it a different car or the same car? I mean, those familiar with the problem, think of the ship of Theseus or Locke's sock and so forth, socks or so forth. So it's a well-known problem. And this is identity and difference over time and the nature of change over time. And again, we need to have a story, some sort of set of rules, if you like, that enable us to deal with this. And finally, is that the last thing is that the different kinds of parts. In a sense, I think Nicola was trying to investigate these. And if we look here, the car right tire seems to be an integral part of it, in the sense that it's always part of it. And the original and new tires are only part for a period of time, and they're not a part at another time. So what's the relation between parted and change over time? How do we explain that it still works? We can go to eight. This is, going through the litmus test. This is if it was on a project that I was working with and we're using the Bohr approach, this is the way I would say I would address the nature of change over time. It's a standard issue, goes back to, well, some modern times, MacTaggart. You can take it back to Heraclitus. And the proposal that I find useful is to go with the idea that there are no real changes and that things are extended at time, we can call it the unreality of change, or change is just being different at different times. And there's an extensive literature, which I suspect most of you are familiar with, at least some of it, if not all of it. If we then go on to slide 9 and try and see what this looks like, I think you've probably seen these space-time maps before. We can see the system in there, the car object number 20. We can see the system component, which is number 25, the two tires in place. So we've actually got a map telling us what the objects are. We actually have introduced something I'll come back to in a second, the component state. This is so that we can explain the nature of parthood at a time. We can see that how it can be the case, and in fact it is natural for it to be the case, that two things are in the same place at the same time. We can also see how they're different. So it explains a number of things. And if we move on to slide 10, what's interesting about this approach, at least for me, is that the way the issues and the questions often disappear under this approach. It's a deflationary approach. And again, when you're working with large-scale systems, it's helpful. I mean, a good dose of the Occam's razor makes things a lot easier. If you start multiplying things and you don't get some compensating benefit, it makes the task more difficult. And certainly if the multiplication goes up exponentially as the scale does, then you've got an awkward problem. So, as I said before, this is the other problem about how do you get identity over time. If you look at if you remember what the picture looked like, the car had car object had one component at another time, one component at another time, but it had a particular spatiotemporal extent. So, if you like, that it's different from one perspective, but because we're taking the whole extent of the object through time, it's just to say it's different is to say it's got looking different at different times. Its temporal stages are different from each other. The overall object is not different. Also, the different kinds of parthood. As I indicated earlier, we saw that there was a difference between the system component being part of the system and the manufactured items being part of them. And in one case, we've got a parthood which lasts through time, a spatiotemporal parthood. In the other case, we've got some kind of overlap, where the object is only a part for a particular period of time. And so we can see why the two things are different, and in fact that the original tower and the replacement tower being part of the car are actually not fully blown parthood in the full sense. They're more some kind of overlap. We now move to slide 11. The other thing that I think helps as well to ground things a bit more is to come up with a criterion of identity. We've talked about whether the things are the same or different. Is if we can actually tie this down, the particular criterion of identity that I favour is, as I think many of you will know, is an existentialist criterion of identity, and it's a common position in philosophy. And again, if you go back to remember how the space-time map looked, the original tower, the replacement tower, and the component all have different spatiotemporal extensions, and therefore, under this criterion, identity of different things. And so our rule works. If we go on to slide 12, can two things be in the same place at the same time? I mentioned this earlier. They can overlap completely for a period of time. Can two things be in the same spatiotemporal extent? No. And I see this in a sense as the spatiotemporal criterion identity is in a sense picking up the intuition that was behind the question of can two things be in the same place at the same time and resolving the problem cases. If you extend it over time, then you get your criterion of identity, but you avoid the awkward problems. If we now move on to slide 13, as Nicholas said earlier, roles appear in a variety of different places, and I think Nicholas' roles are probably wider than this overlapping pattern that I'm talking about. But it is still pretty commonplace, and here in slide 13 is an example of a the chairman of the bank, similar to Nicola's example of the presidency, so though we're showing the two people, where it would be equivalent to Nicola's example with Berlusconi? No, he wasn't the president, he was the prime minister, wasn't he? I'm not sure. Anyway, my knowledge of Italian politics is not particularly good. But at one time, Mr. Smith is the chairman, and at another time, Mr. Jones is the chairman. Even visually, you can see it's the same pattern as the car's wheel. Now, the reason for moving to organization, if we move to slide 14, is an interesting example that I was checking over my emails and I noticed I actually raised firstly with Nicola, I think, over 10 years ago. And it's the notion of a corporation soul. And I think I'm not sure of the exact detail. Some of the lawyers in the audience might know more. But I think it was came into existence in medieval times. I'm not sure in England only or across the whole of Europe. And it was introduced with a problem with bishops. Bishops in those days could get married legally and have children. And when property was given to the bishop, the bishops, understandably, I suppose, assumed that it was theirs and they could give it to their children. And so the church wanted to have some way they could keep hand on its property. So it introduced the notion of a corporate soul and the fact that the corporation soul could own the property. So the property was actually owned by the corporation soul, the bishop, rather than the person who was occupying the role of the bishop. It got extended in various ways. An important extension was to the monarch. One of the problems was that monarchs declared war and then got killed or in their executing their battle, something that doesn't happen so much nowadays. And the idea was is that if the monarch declared war, the corporation soul declared war, even though the individual person who was occupying that position was killed, the war wasn't over. So in a sense, you didn't necessarily win your battle by killing the monarch because you were still at war. And I think what's interesting is that this is an example of a system component if you regard the bishop as being part of the church or the monarch as being part of the state. A system component that can do things, can declare war, has responsibilities, owns property and so forth. And it's difficult to see how a virtual object could do this. Now, you can argue the case in a number of different ways, but it does seem to be a problematic case for the people who adopt a virtual approach. We can go to slide 15. In here, I was trying to characterise the choices that I displayed on the ontological architecture by characterising the choices that I'd made with other possible choices and in a sense trying to justify which way we're going. One of the things that I noticed in Nicola's paper was talking about the virtual object having a clear spatial location. I'm not so sure how this is completely true. There does seem to be some vagueness in it. In Nicola's case, if you can think of the headlamp is movable, say it can be in an open or a closed position. When you have a virtual and no physical headlamp there, we don't know whether it's open or closed. So there's an extent of vagueness about the spatial position that maybe undermines the notion that it does have a strong physical position. Similarly, the corporation soul issue that I've just raised. If we then move on to slide 16, the other issue, and this I remember discussing this with Nicola when I was at the lab, is that there's a problem of virtual plenitude. You do seem to, and I think as Baker says there, you get a radical multiple approach. You get more and more virtual and real things. So you have a real car with a real headlamp and a virtual headlamp. The real headlamp has a bulb. Presumably the virtual headlamp has a bulb and so on. And so you get what seems to me quite a vicious multiplication. And if you're trying to do some kind of configuration management, if you've got to keep track of all these, there's an extra burden. And also from a principal point of view is that what role does Occam's razor play in this? Is it, as Occam's razor suggests, that this is probably something that's worth looking at or not? And if we move to the next slide, which I think is the last slide, there was also something that interests me in some of the things that Nicola said, certainly in relation to design, is that it seems to me that design has an aspect which I haven't brought out in this, and which I think Nicola was bringing out in his paper, in the sense that's deontic. So when we're designing something, we're intending that it should be built that way. And it's quite common, I think, to, in a possible world semantics, to have the design, then what you actually built, and then what you would have built if it's been built as you designed it in some other possible world. So there's some explanation from, in a possible world semantics, of the deontic situation. There is a further complication, as it seems to me, is that certainly for most engineering, or many engineering things that you do, Nicola's house is probably an exception, is that you build a type. So when you build, design a laptop, a ship, an aircraft, you're actually designing the type. And when you talk about the position, you're talking about the position in a prototypical instance. So a lot of language saying this is where it would be is you're saying, if this was a prototypical instance, it would be here. I'm not sure you're saying that this particular instance is headlamp wheel is going to necessarily be here, unless it is actually there. Okay, I think that's me finished.
Thank you very much, Chris. Once again, I think I'd like to wait questions, and if you have questions, please ask them on SOPA. Because we're still struggling with time here. Well, next up is myself doing an imitation of David Leal, and the subject of this talk is some thoughts on requirements for languages in engineering. So if you could move on to the first slide, please. Okay, so you've heard, in fact, in the previous two talks, that amongst other things, we need both classes and instances. But in developing ISO 15996, we found that we needed not just classes, but classes of class, and even classes of class of class on a few occasions. This kind of thing doesn't need to be a problem for practical queries, but you, in depending on what you're doing or inferencing in, you need to, you may need to take some action to accommodate this need. There's also a need to be able to treat class level information and instance level information in an analogous way, and Chris was in fact just talking about this difference between the design, where there's a type, and an instantiation of that, really looking very much having just the same structure, but actually being realized, and that being able to treat the two in a very similar way, even though one is at a class level and the other is at an individual level, is an important thing to be able to do. And the last question here is what about variables? Parameterized designs and optimization within design spaces are important things, and how to deal with parameterization is not easily something that you can easily see how best to do that. So if we could move on to slide 3, please, and so this is just the first topic, so straight on to slide 4, please. So what you can see here is that in classification we need to classify things multiple times. I'll explain that this is in principle a turtle diagram, and so the A means is an instance of. It's my aluminium plate is an instance of part type XYZ_1/V2. And that in turn is an instance of part type. And similarly, with the other classifications, the other direct classifications, and then those classifications have a classification. And this is a quite general pattern that you find. Next slide, please. So that's slide 4. Oh, sorry, that's just the build, isn't it? Yes, and this gives you a Sparkle query to get the alloy type of my aluminium plate out of that collection of data. Slide 5, please. Okay, so things are multiply classified, but sometimes a relationship with a quantity is just a classification too. So here we have that, for instance, my aluminium plate weighs, when you say that it weighs 10 or has a mass of 10.3 kilograms, there is 10.3 kilograms, which classifies the aluminium plate, and there is mass, which tells you what 10.3 kilograms is, what sort of thing 10.3 kilograms is. So again, you quite naturally get these multiple levels of classification. Slide 6, please. And again, here we have a bit of Sparkle to help us do that. Slide 7. And it can really get quite difficult to keep track of all these things. So here we have not just classifications, but also subclasses coming into the picture. And indeed, there are three relationships which dominate their classification, specialization, or subclass of, and whole part, and some different sorts of whole part of that. Slide 8, please. One of the things that can help actually quite a lot is the use of power classes. Now, a power class is one where here, if we take aluminium alloy object as a class, then it might have a number of subclasses, and all of those subclasses would be an instance of class of aluminium alloy object. Indeed, that's the definition of what power type means. It's all the possible subtypes. Slide 9, please. So we also need to treat class level and individual level of information in analogous ways. So this is looking at the difference between the design, or the similarity, I should say, between the design level and the realized level. Next slide, please. This is slide 10. So here's a car wiring diagram, and it's really quite interesting. This is typical of what you might have with your car. Each symbol on the diagram actually represents a class of component. But when I'm working on my car, I assume that each symbol represents an individual component of my car. The ambiguity here is really quite useful. Okay, next slide, please, slide 11. And here we are. So, but the relationships here are actually relationships between classes. And the relationships between the actual individuals are instances of those class, well, what are really classes of relationship. Next slide, slide 12, please. Okay, this is a digression. And this is actually part of how we solved this problem in ISO 15096. We actually found we had to create what we called an instance notation, which enabled us to deal with different levels of classification and individuals as well, and combine them in one diagram. And we found this a particularly useful thing to be able to do. So here we've got an example of Fred Logs, who is a member of Dog Owner, and Dog Owner is a subclass of Legal Entity. Then, of course, we have Things, and Dog is a subclass of Thing, via a few intermediate ones, and then we have Fido, who is an instance of Dog. So what you can see is that the class level objects are with the thick black lines and the individual level objects are with the thin lines. And we have a relationship instance of Fred owns Fido at the bottom. And that's an instance of ownership of Dog, which is between dogs and dog owners. And that in turn is a subclass of ownership, which is a graph selected by range restriction, or at least that's what you want it to be. One of the problems we actually have in ISO 15996 is that we didn't design the language in order to be able to support the definition of, you know, a dog owner is someone who owns a dog. You know, anyone who owns a dog is a dog owner. It's not done as that kind of definition. It just allows you to create the boxes that enable you to say the right thing. So what ISO 15926 enables you to do is state that Fred Bloggs is a dog owner and that Fido is a dog. But you could have said that Fred Bloggs is a legal entity and Fido is a thing, or even that Fido is a dog, and that Fred owns Fido is an instance of ownership rather than ownership of dog. And you wouldn't, you aren't constrained to that meaning that Fred Bloggs is a dog owner. Okay, next slide, please, slide 13. So what you really want is what, if you just convert this into OWL, you get an equivalence class, which you can see effectively combines the class of relationship with the class and says, yeah, it is those that own dogs are what dog owners are. And that's something that we need to add. Slide 14, please. Okay, so, yes, as David says here, ISO 15996 now are equivalent, but we just need a way in 15996 to make that link that says, yep, actually this is how you define dog owner. Slide 15, please. Okay. Now here's where things start to get a bit more complicated, and we see this two level where we have a design at one level and we have real individual instances at the next level down. And so this is that, going back to that wiring diagram, this is a sort of an instance level model and a class level model for that wiring diagram. The next slide, please, slide 16. So an AC system fan relay and AC system fan relay after run are two design occurrences of relay type XYZ. And AC fan, yeah, okay, so this is just showing those instantiations. Slide 17, please. So, an RDF-OWL representation does not treat class and individual level information in analogous ways. You can't do some of the things that you can do with the ISO 15996 notation. Slide 18, please. So, lastly, what about variables? Next slide, please. That's slide 19. So why do you need variables? Designers define a design space, design spaces. So it's an optimal or manufacturable design is then something which exists within that space. Now, a design space is a class that contains individual designs as members. These are the possible designs that you could have. A design space is defined by ranges of variables, i.e. some finite set of choices. A specific design within a design space can also be expressed in terms of variables, where an instance of the design binds the variables to the individuals. So let's come and have a look at this. Next slide, please, slide 20. So a car wiring diagram. So we have our air conditioning system as a free variable, and we've got two bound variables, the system fan relay and the system fan relay after run. Next slide, please, slide 21. And here's the binding to AC system in my car, relay serial number 98/1224 and relay serial 99/2375. Next slide, please, slide 22. So where can we go with variables? David believes that an expression involving variables can, with sufficient effort, be expressed in terms of mappings between classes. We use variables because they make life easier. So far, attempts to record a design as a formal set of statements have not made use of variables. And those attempts have not been successful because the complexity of information in a design makes it difficult. So recording a design space is even more difficult. And so some So more work is needed in that area. Next slide, please. I think, yes, that's right. And that's it from me for David. Again, if you have questions, please, if you could put them in the forum. We now move to Henson Graves and his talk on model architectures, big systems challenges. There we go. Over to you, Henson. Are you there with us?
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay,
thank you.
Great. Chart one, I want to give you some background about this talk. First, I assembled these charts yesterday, but all the charts but one are 6 years old. And the assembly was done very quickly, so, you know, if I were doing it today, I would actually change it a little bit. But the real background is it's based on, I would say, 7 years of experience as the architect of an information system for a very large multinational program. And I think actually the best description would be as an ontology architect, and we'll get into that. The term ontology architect is pretty new, but it was certainly during that time, the last few years, I did use the term ontology. And actually before that 7 years, I had about 5 years building federated information systems and workbenches and a lot of the other topics that, you know, are covered in some of the other tracks. And at least one person here knew me in that context when I was a technical lead of a program there. And while the technology has come a long way over this last, you know, 12 or so years, a lot of the fundamental problems remain, and that's what I really want to talk about as to what they are and what I think the real problems are, what the causes are, and what can be done about it, and specifically where ontology plays into that. And just one final thing on the first chart is that actually putting the charts together and putting the single new chart in was sort of really came about when I was thinking about Matthew's distillation unit and some of the issues there that helped me figure out a conceptualization problem that has been on my mind for a long time. So let's go to chart two. The kind of systems I'm talking about are the ones that are built, maintained, used in very large multinational enterprises that, you know, obviously incorporate many disciplines, whatever they may be, engineering, management, financial, you name it. And in one sense, what you see is that many of the large programs are over budget, you know, late time-wise and produce not very good systems, or they don't work very well. And so, you know, poor quality. And what I've seen over and over in my context is that a program has a successful technical review, and then 6 months later, they're totally in the ditch, and management has no idea. They're totally blindsided. And it's very interesting to try to understand why that's the cause, or, you know, why it's that way, and what you can do about it. And the cause, simply, but it must require thinking about, is the inability to maintain an accurate, coherent model of the system and the development process. And so let's go to the third chart. And what this comes down to with large systems now is the root cause, I would say, is with the enterprise modeling. And the reason is that the models are the ground truth for management. In this day and age, you can't walk the factory floor to figure out what's going on because the factory floor is all over the world and it's too complicated. And so that doesn't work. So all the thing that you have, so the real ground truth of it is the models. you know, the little blue clouds down there, or their formalized versions, be they in UML, Excel, text, or whatever. And so this is the one new chart in the deck. I've edited them just a little bit. But the thing is that the number of models that it takes to cover the enterprise is enormous. And they're always incoherent, inconsistent, not trustworthy, and you can't find them. And so the real problem then is it's an example of the you know, control system law, is if you can't measure it, you can't control it. And so if you don't know what's going on, you can't manage it. And it's very hard to know what's going on because there's nobody, there's no way that you can understand all these models and put them together. But that's also by thinking about this picture, and people may not agree with some of the names on here, but let's push on and look at chart 4, which is a kind of picture. Again, this chart, remember, is about 6 years old. And on the left-hand side of it, you see a little bit of a tree for top-level decomposition of a product variant. And in this case, one had many variants of this product that you were building, all different. They shared certain similarity, but there were a lot of differences. And so the management of all of that was extremely difficult. And is a good topic for ontology, is the whole business about variance. Also, is while in this program, the product model part was presumably done in UML, is there were a lot of other tools that were used that overlapped the overlapped that. And if you look carefully, they use different product breakdowns. So not surprisingly, there was a lot of confusion. And for the different subsystems, they had an enormous number of attributes that, you know, safety, reliability, weight, all kinds of things like that, that had to be managed, that had to be, there were whole teams to deal with weight, who first started to estimate the weight based on what they knew, and then as the design progressed, refined that. And again, you know, weight, it was a particular case where some year or so into the program, the weight projection suddenly jumped very high that caused the down. And it was totally unexpected. And then for all these different things that attributes that you may have to measure or analyze, there are all kinds of analysis results that use methods, and they actually use the analysis methods are a result of doing some kind of tests. And all of this are the models that constitute the data that have to be managed. And so you can maybe you can get some sense of how complex this might be on a large program. Go to the next chart. Well, and again, remember, 6 years old is, to me, I put together the first chart, and then I realized that I could use an upper ontology to sort of organize it. And so that's what you see here. And again, there may be some disagreements of whether I've got it right, because again, I did this when I first discovered upper ontologist Dolce about 6-7 years ago. And, but that did allow me to sort of first organize it and at least categorize the whole architecture for the information system that was the whole management of the program. This, of course, is the technical stuff rather than the financial, but it's similar. And so you could, and what came out of this for me was, is that something like Dolce or some, version of an upper ontology was absolutely the right thing to organize all of this. And so that's what I did. And in fact, building things like the product variants and CFD methods and so on, I'd originally gotten all of that by looking through the top-level program documents program plans. It said, here's what we're going to have to produce. That is, and here are the things that we use to produce it. And so that's really what this chart is about. But there's one more thing that you could do, and that's maybe go to the next chart. Well, first, here is just, you can look. This is, again, some years ago, where I pulled a version of Dolce into L1.1, and you could just look and see, oh, well, these are the things that are circled are the things that made sense in doing the architecture of the top-level enterprise ontology. And so it first just provided enormous conceptual simplification of the problem. And then to go on to the next case, but there was something more needed, and this again a long time ago, is if you looked at something like an analysis result, it had a pattern, it had a template, and the template was the things that you would expect in the actual model. So, you know, like it satisfies the description, it applies to stress loads, it's a result of some kind of process execution, and it has then data stored someplace. So what we did then was build some of these templates for things like plans, for analysis results, for test results, and use that to try to encourage or force people to use those templates in the building of their data, in whatever building of their models, rather, in whatever language, be it spreadsheets or what else. And the idea worked quite well. It wasn't fully carried through. And the thing I realized very recently is that these templates are, I think you could call them metamodels or maybe formal ontologies. I had originally thought that the model was just a specialization, but my current view is that the models are instances of these metamodels. And so that seems to be the better way to me to think about it. I know some people probably disagree with it, but the whole idea sort of makes sense regardless of the details. So the next chart is, and we did use these enterprise models or data models to build an architecture which glued together a bunch of separate databases. Now, this was pretty hard to do. It's gotten a lot easier over the time that I worked on this. And I believe that the system that we actually built sat here in the middle and accessed data from a lot of standalone systems that were just slightly internet accessible. And we were able to allow people to search and find things and enter things and do stuff like that. Worked pretty well. So just the conclusion of all this is that the real thing is that this model management is the single greatest challenge. And to mitigate that is find a good foundation ontology for all these artifacts, develop a template for each of the concepts, and use that to glue together your information system. And I have sort of partial evidence that it works, and, you know, it was partially realized and was a partial success. And, of course, in the process of all this, I did look at what a lot of other people were doing as well, you know, friends and enemies and other kinds of industries and so on. And it kind of confirmed the things that I, at least to me, that I'm talking about. And so that's really, that's it. I'm done.
Thank you very much, Henson. That was really useful. There are a few questions on the chat, but what I'm going to do now, if we could have our other speakers unmuted, if you could unmute yourselves. If we can now throw things open to questions, I think there's a bit of time. Are there any questions? If you'd like to put your hand up in the chat room, I'll call people out. We could have a very short question time.
Well, while people are gathering questions, as I'll point out that the kind of things that were being talked about earlier, like the replacing the tires and so on, are very much the point when you look down in the details of trying to model, a product that's being built that maybe is under test and things like that, and later on during its life cycle. So those are very real questions. And those are actually questions that I'm, personally very interested in and so on. But the talk that I gave is really the background of, a lot of experience in trying to understand why big programs so often were so unsuccessful in some sense and what could be done about it.
Yes, and one of the things that I find is something that comes out from Nicola's talk is that role is not really just one thing. There are lots of subtleties in roles and different sorts of roles when you dig into them. And there's a lot of confusion, really, from just using the word role to describe that plethora of subtly related ideas. Would you agree with that, Nicola?
Matthew, I strongly agree with you. Of course, maybe you may wonder whether this kind of analyzing this kind of subtleties is relevant, but in my experience it is. So being able to distinguish between different kinds of roles is very relevant. Just to mention one thing I realized recently, in many cases we think of these role players are actually parts of your artifact. In some cases, some roles are played by what we call features for instance, the living room in my example. The living room, well, maybe it is not really a part of the house. Let's say a hole in a plate in order to host a bolt. Well, of course, the hole is not a part of the plate, and still plays a role. And distinguishing between, let's say, mereologic roles, roles played by parts, which are the majority of them, from roles played by things which are not parts, might really make a difference in the engineering discussion.
Yes, indeed. Chris, is there something you'd like to add to that on the question of roles more generally and the confusion that that causes?
Yes. Okay. I think your comment is correct about there being a variety of different roles. I think Nicola's comment about non-mereological roles is quite interesting. I was involved in a project where we're looking, it was quite important where the center of mass of an object was, and it turned out it was a radar, I don't know what they called it, was a piece of radar that was curved, so the center of mass was not a part of it. So I think mereology isn't the answer to everything, and I think there are subtleties. I'm not sure that natural language is always the best way to go. I sometimes think that for the kind of large systems that we're looking at, it'd be better to get access to the data that's being used, because then you're closer to the problem. And I think natural language is old. It's got a lot of history and different applications. So it's not always a good guide to what you should do. But yes, I think understanding the subtleties of roles is good. The issue for me, interesting issue for me, and I was looking at some of the questions on there, is where these principles fit in an architecture. It would be nice to have a block diagram. And it seems to me that the questions about mereology and identity are quite close to the top. whereas I think some of the subtleties to do with roles are further on down, and I think it's quite important when you're doing your architecture to try and work out where you place these particular things in terms of scope and the way they go across and the way the principles go across. Is that enough, Matthew?
Matthew?
Oh, sorry, was that was I not right. visible? Sorry. We have a question from Jack Ring. Has his hand up. Would you like to make your question, Jack?
I'm struck by the lack of examples for things like enthusiasm, tenacity, etc., which are necessary for modeling human activity systems. And the relevance is that Warfield warned years ago that as the problematic situation becomes large enough, then the designers become the problem. Not the problematic situation any longer, but the design team becomes the problem to be solved. And we cannot deal with big systems without coping with ways of modeling the human activity system that will generate the design for the big system. So I'm wondering where we might, this notion of the language for modeling systems seems to me to be not anywhere near complete enough.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we see as well. I know that with ISO 15996, we don't just have a way of modeling the systems themselves, but also the activities and the types of activities and the roles that people play and all those other things too. And so I certainly agree with the basic premise that those are things you have to be able to do. Nicola, do you have a thought on that?
Well, two things. First, a comment to Jack. I agree on very much on the point that we have to include people and human activities in our models, as indeed Matthew was suggesting. And this is why I'm really convinced that, especially in the perspective of big systems, these big systems are big socio-technical systems, and we have to explicitly put into our models attitudes people have with respect to, for instance, the artifacts, and so on. And I believe I try to show how taking these explicit attitudes of people is important in understanding subtle differences between between roles, for instance, and between the way we see things. So, and this is in addition, let's say, a point concerning motivating the deep respect I I have towards concepts. There are not just things there. There are ideas, opinions, attitudes, expectations, and all these things. Anyway, this is one thing. On a different side, since I mentioned halls and non-mereological roles, of course, as certainly you know, halls have a very important play, are very important in engineering design, in mechanical design, and so on. So we definitely need to reify them, to be able to talk of them. So halls exist, they have their own individuality and so on. I believe that this is one of the, this introduces a problem in the 4D approach because, at least in my opinion, I have to distinguish between, I have to be aware of the fact that if there is a pin inserted into a hole, well, two things exist, the hole and the pin, and they occupy exactly the same space. The cavity is there, occupies, I guess, the same space as the pin, at least part of the pin, and still they are different. So this is a problem for me.
Yes. Okay, Nicola, thank you for that. Henson, your hand is up if you're next.
Yes. I'd like to sort of, just back to some of the comments that Jack and a few other people made, is modeling human behavior is interesting. And actually, I have been involved in that. But in terms of that having a lot to do with whether a manager knows whether his program is on track or not, that is, like, to build and design an automobile, I think down in the weeds. And so when the managers can't find out what the state of the design is, that's where the problem is in a gross level way. And that's a situation that I see over and over. So the other stuff is interesting, and in some context, not this, very important to model. But in terms of solving the problem of why major programs are so, cost overrun and so on, it's not people's attitudes. It's that they don't know what is that the people that run the thing don't know what the state of the design is.
Okay, thank you. Jack, you have another point, please?
Yes, please. 2 points. Number one, I'm diametrically opposed, in my view, to what Henson just stated. The reason management doesn't know the state of the design is because in the project plan, no one put in a task that said, know the state of the design. In other large-scale systems, we've learned over the years that that is one of the key activities that the project system must accomplish in order to create a decent user system. The main point I want to make is that recently we have been able to recover all the work of Professor Rudolf Stargerman, which I think is fundamental to the need of modeling human activity systems. And that work is now at www.starkerman.com. I put it here in the chat list. And I'd really encourage people to take a look at that website. Starkerman did this over the last 40 years. It really is stunning. The social science people who should be interested can't understand the mathematics, and the engineering people who can understand the mathematics seem to believe that people aren't important anyway, so they don't deal with it. Hopefully, we can get this group to pay a little attention to what Starkerman has been telling us for 40 years. End of commercial. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jack. That's helpful. Peter, you're next.
I agree with Jack, and I want to follow up on Nicola's point about including people, because that is what I've been working on for the past 2 or 3 decades, actually. So, a question for Nicola and then the ontologists among us is that when we start modeling all these other things, is it a necessity that we will have to leave the elegance and simplicity of first order logic and introduce modal logic? So maybe Nicola and Matthew, Chris,
yeah,
could sort of
I'm quite happy to pick up on that. There are different ways of addressing modal logic, and you'll probably be aware that in ISO 15096 and in other things that I've been involved in, we followed Lewis with the possible worlds approach. And of course, one of the advantages of possible worlds is that it doesn't take you outside first order logic. That's one of the advantages that it has. If you go for other kinds of modal logic, you may have less luck.
I am exactly in agreement with Matthew. Model logic doesn't require going in second order. And by the way, to me, any ontological endeavor is unavoidably modal. Modality is necessary for doing ontology.
And modality is necessary for doing engineering because it's all about intent.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I completely agree with that.
Okay, that's good stuff. That was a good question, Peter. Thank you for that. Henson, you're next with your hand up. Jack?
Let me second that I agree that some form of modal logic is absolutely essential. The details of what makes best sense is unclear to me at this stage, but something along those lines. So I'm agreeing with everybody there. One point back to Jack is the program plans did have in them to assess the state of the design. The problem is it couldn't be done, is what it really amounted to. Of course, people, the management talked to the subordinates and the technical people and so on and finally put together presentations, but it wasn't based on reality. And that's where the programs go wrong.
Yeah, but the reason for that, Henson, is that, I mean, I think I agree with Jack here. You can only do it if you designed it in. And if you didn't design it in, you may not be able to do it.
It was designed in that you had to answer the question, but the mechanisms to enable you to answer the questions were not designed in.
Exactly. If you haven't gone from we need to be able to answer this question to, and this is the information we need to be able to answer the question to, and these are the processes that are going to create the information so that we can answer the question, you actually have to follow through. If you don't follow through, you shouldn't expect to be able to do it, which I think was the essence of what Jack was saying.
If that's what he's saying, I would agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a state of confusion I'm sure we've all seen in various places at various times. It's a classic indication of a dysfunctional organization. Okay, thanks, Henson. Jack, your hand's up again.
Phil Crosby a number of years ago said that, the quality guru said that as the company gets larger, management finds it increasingly difficult to know what's going on and impossible to know what's not going on.
Yes.
And we have shown over the last several years that does not need to be the case. If, in fact, one has a prescriptive model for what should be going on, then one can always notice what's not going on.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think having a systematic way to develop the model of what your organization ought to be doing. Once you have a model of what they ought to be doing, you can then check whether it's actually doing it. But without the model of what it ought to be doing, you don't know what questions to ask.
Yes, sir. So we spend our time focusing on how to model an airplane as a big system or some other, you know, thing like that, when in fact, as in big systems, the problem is the people who are supposed to be doing the modeling in the first place.
That's right. You need to model how you model an aircraft.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Couldn't agree more. Okay, thank you very much, Jack. Are there any more questions? We're getting towards the end of our time, so I'm not desperate for more questions, but there's time for one or two more if there are some. Okay, well, there being none, I would like to thank our four speakers for their erudite presentations, and thank you for joining us all. And thank you in particular, Peter, for all your efforts making this happen.
Well, I should thank everyone. I mean, those who are putting the sessions together and those who are coming to join us and contributing. That's it for today. And
thank
come back next week when Todd Schneider and Ali Hashemi plus all the contributing editors to the communique and other deliverables come show us their work in progress so that we get ready for the culmination event on April 12th and 13th at NIST, which we call the Summit Workshop and Symposium. And by the way, for those of you who plan to be there, please register. Registration is open, and you can't get into the NIST campus without registering. Of course, the event also supports participation as well.
Hi, Peter. This is Ali here. Can people hear me?
Yep.
Hi. So I just want to take this opportunity to give a quick reminder to the track champions that Todd Schneider and I would very much appreciate a short description of the tracks as outlined in Todd's email earlier. I'll send out an email reminder as well.
Okay. Could you give us an idea of, in the email, of how much you are looking for? I presume that you want less than 10 pages and more than 2 lines. Something a little bit more precise than that would probably be...
I'll put a reference word amount then.
Yeah. Just, I mean, clearly not a rule, but just as a guide.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you very much, Ali.
Thank you.
Right. Good afternoon or evening, everyone, then.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Great session.